And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO with Martin Willis and Michael Lauck. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com. Check out the latest blogs and forums. And while you're there, don't forget to like our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauck will be joining us for the news in a second. Today is podcast number 73. We have a great guest this week. He's an astronomer and he's also a person into the UFO scene. His name is Mark D'Antonio. It's kind of a sciencey type show, but I just love this stuff. Before we introduce Michael here, I want to give a shout out to a guy named Casper, and he's a great guy on our Facebook page, and he's been spreading the word everywhere. He's out in California. Thanks a lot, Casper. And I guess we're ready to roll into the news. Michael, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing this week?
I am doing just fine. Thank you.
All right. Well, this week, because we have a science-y kind of guest, we're going to start with a science-y kind of story. How's that?
Perfect.
All right. A new study says our galaxy is teeming with Earth-like planets. A study published earlier this week by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science suggests that 1 in 5 sun-like stars that were studied by the Kepler telescope have a planet in the so-called Goldilocks zone where liquid water could exist. This suggests that Earth-like planets could be very common throughout the galaxy, although it does not provide a way to estimate how many of these planets actually support life.
Yeah, we are going to be actually talking about this in the podcast today with Mark D'Antonio, but it really is something, if you think about it, in some ways I think it's fascinating. In other ways, I think, why would we be so special that we'd be visited by other life out there if there's up to 17 billion planets in just our galaxy alone that could possibly support life? Why are we so special being visited, or is everyone visiting everyone? I don't know what's going on. What do you think?
Well, I actually think this kind of lends credence to the intergalactic pit stop theory, as I like to call it, that ships come by here just to stock up on a little bit of water. And if water is fairly common throughout the universe, and it is necessary for life throughout the universe, it's probably more practical to not lug around a huge, heavy amount of water if you know you can replenish your supplies as you go.
You know, we should be able to cash in on this, maybe make some like UFO rest area or something, you know, with mechanics and the whole works. What do you think? A little truck stop, little go-go girls, all that?
I think the key is providing clean bathrooms and 24-hour service.
That's a good business model. I'll buy it. Hey, Michael, before we go too much further, I would like to drag in our Facebook admin, Peggy Shunning. How you doing, Peggy?
Hi, guys. Doing good. How about you?
Good. I thanked you many times on the show, but now I want to thank you in front of everybody for doing
Never enough, is it?
Well, thanks for all the great work you do.
You're welcome.
A lot of postings. I don't know where you find that stuff, but thanks so much
for it.
Make it up. Like everyone else, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Peggy, why don't you sit in with us for the rest of the news?
All right. I'd love to.
Okay.
Can I comment? I want to comment on the pit stop.
Okay. Go ahead.
Michael, I don't think intelligent beings from another planet would have to use a bathroom.
Maybe not, but they're going to need water, and water's heavy.
I was just thinking that. I thought, oh, God, I hope they've advanced more than that, than they need to use bathrooms. And here's my feeling about all those findings of the Goldilocks zones in our neighborhood. I actually found it a little discouraging, because if they're that many, where are they? And if they're not there, if there's no life there, what does that say about the rest of the universe?
Well, again, you need to remember that it's 1 in 5 sun-like stars, not 1 in 5 stars.
Did I say 1 in 5 stars?
Percentage of the stars. No, but hold on, I'm building up a point here. It's 1 in 5 sun-like stars. So that does cut down on the number. And then on top of that, what can and can't support life, I mean, it's still kind of subject to our best approximation at this point, which is the Drake equation.
I understand all that, Michael. I'm just saying that if in our, you know, near neighborhood, there is life, and a lot of people think there is and think we're being visited, why isn't it more obvious?
I'm going to let you two guys battle this out.
All right. Well, that's just a question that no one knows yet the answer to yet. Yeah. That's okay. I was just giving you my take on it. I find it discouraging.
Let's go back to bathrooms.
Yeah.
I happened to have a nice long conversation with Travis Walton a few months ago. And I said,
did he talk about that?
Well, I said, hey, Travis, you were stuck on this spacecraft or whatever it was for 5 days. So what were the bathrooms like? So I thought that was a reasonable question.
Yeah.
And he said no one had ever asked him about that. And he said that the time that he was on there just seemed like a couple of hours to him. So that's all he remembers. But I just thought I'd bring the restrooms back into the conversation. Cool you two guys down so we can move on.
All right. It worked.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to the next story, Michael.
All right. Bob Salas claims to have been abducted. Bob Salas, who is the retired Air Force captain who publicly speaks about his personal experience with a UFO that affected a nuclear missile site, has now revealed that he was abducted by aliens almost 20 years after the event. He claims that he was aware of the 1985 abduction, but he did undergo hypnosis to recover details. Mr. Salas' wife was also involved in the experience.
Yeah. This is kind of shocking. You know, I'm going to stay kind of neutral on this. You guys want to talk about it?
It's interesting. I have a hard time understanding why he waited so long. Maybe that's not even a relevant question. And if he might feel that might muddy the waters of his already, reported knowledge of the UFO phenomenon. I worry that his brain is so contaminated. I know mine is. I had a UFO encounter, a close encounter when I had a close encounter when I was, 30 years later. I have read so much and gone to so many symposiums that I think if I were hypnotized now, I could come up with a very plausible abduction scenario and not be able to tell myself whether it was true or not because I know too much.
The woman who knew too much.
Exactly. I mean, did that make sense that to undergo hypnosis when you know that so much about the field and what other, abductees are reported? I don't know how that couldn't contaminate your memories.
Well, I really don't know how the hypnosis regression works exactly, so I can't really answer that question. I'm not sure. You know, I do find it curious that he did wait a while, but also it says that he recently underwent regression through hypnosis, so perhaps that's why he's coming out with it now. I'm not really sure that if I was in his shoes that I would have ever actually come out with it. I don't know about that.
Well, I kind of liken the abduction experiences to sexual abuse, not necessarily in to stigmatize that or anything else, but in that it is a heavy trauma for most people who are many people who are involved in it. And if you think of people who have been abused as children, they often keep it to themselves for years and years and years. And I think there's very few known, definite, provable phenomena that we can draw a parallel to, and that's one of them. And when you look at that, people keep it quiet for years. Also, on the hypnosis point, it has its pros and cons. I'm not a huge necessarily fan of hypnosis, but I have seen in investigations of past life experiences, I have seen them ask someone who is spewing this amazing story about, living in yesteryear, where they got this knowledge. and seeing the person under hypnosis then spout out the title and author of the book that they got all this information from. So there might be a filter. I'm not entirely sure, but it might not be as bad as it could be, because, yeah, obviously after decades, people are going to amass a lot more knowledge if they're in the UFO field, like Peggy points out. But I think if hypnosis is done correctly, theoretically, it takes you back to a certain point in time. And
yeah, you know, I'm sorry, Michael, but they're coming up with so many studies about memory now and how unreliable it is. Even first, you know, witnesses on the stand, eyewitnesses. You can have five eyewitnesses, and they'd have five different reports of what they've seen. I'm not denying that it happens. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I have more of a tendency to doubt the accuracy if someone has been that involved in the field. Same with Stephen Greer.
Well, has Mr. Salas actually gone into great detail about his abduction experience? I admit that
I've
read about it mainly through Robert Hastings' writings, yeah. Not anything else.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not really aware of that. I just saw a little bit online. I read about it.
Well, I'll be open-minded about it. I certainly, you know, am not predisposed to disbelieve it. I'm just, you know, looking at it from all angles, I guess.
And Robert Hastings himself actually says that he's going to be investigating it more. And he also said that there are a number of people that have witnessed the UFO nukes situation that are reporting a similar experience. So
that's interesting. Well, and look at the man that you had on a few weeks ago that was a witness to Travis Walton.
Right. Stephen Pierce.
He claims that he had an encounter years later. And I was pretty dismissive of that. But maybe it is true.
Maybe
all you have to do is be a witness to these things. I wonder about the Rendlesham Forest people. Are they coming forward years later to say that they've had abduction experiences?
All right. Art Bell throws in the towel. Art Bell has abruptly left SiriusXM not even 2 months after his new show Dark Matters launched. Bell has stated that this is in reaction to the unreliability of the SiriusXM streaming service, which prevents many from hearing the show, except those in vehicles. This, he says, leads to the bulk of his callers being on cell phones and vehicles, which creates difficulties for his caller-driven radio show. Art had called for SiriusXM to allow free streaming of the show for a year, something which the network rejected.
It was a real flash in the pan, wasn't it? It wasn't too many shows. I know there's a lot of people were complaining out there, but I got to tell you something. I really enjoyed the shows that he was doing. I really think he is tremendously talented. And I've heard a couple of people say, you know, he lost his edge a little bit, but I still was really enjoying what he was doing. And I'm kind of sad to see him go, but my thoughts are is that he won't be gone for long, that he's going to figure something out. I mean, why not with his base he has now? Depending on his contract with SiriusXM, he could start live streaming himself right from his website. And if you noticed, right from day one, he's been driving people right to his website. So who knows what's going to happen?
Well, I think based on his past history, he'll be back.
Yeah.
And then he'll quit. And then he'll be back. And then he'll quit. And then he'll be back. I mean, that's been his MO. It's kind of sad. I am not one that found his shows that riveting. How about you, Michael?
I was actually always a big fan of Art, but I kind of think this is all a load of crap, personally.
Yeah. He started out with a lot of feuds, airing his grievances and feuds, and maybe that was all to drum up business. Who knows? But I was kind of put off by that. And then the fact that his shows were 4 hours long was almost too much, I thought.
Well, the show used to be 5 hours long when it was on.
Did it really?
When it was on the radio, yeah. When Art did Coast, it was 5 hours long. He also did broke up usually and had several guests.
Mm-hmm.
I think when he came back, I mean, when I heard he came back, I looked briefly at Sirius XM again. I have looked at it and decided not to get it many times over the years. And this was another one. One of the things I looked at was because I know what I'm doing at night. I knew I wasn't going to be necessarily in my car. I looked at their streaming service. I saw there were some complaints about it. I saw the price and kind of wrote it off from there. But, I mean, that shouldn't surprise him, A. B,
he knew that going in.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly. B, go, you know, as far as people on cell phones, he used to always throw fits when people were on cordless phones. I mean, it's been a number of years since he's on the radio. And honestly, how many people have solid wired landlines?
I know,
in
they
their
don't
home?
Even have landlines anymore. And
10%.
You know, I was thinking about Howard Stern's show. I mean, he gets tons of callers, doesn't he? I don't listen to it, but isn't part of his show a call-in show?
I remember right, he does. Not a real large part of it, but part of it. Yeah.
It's been years, but yeah, as I recall, it was too, even after he jumped over to satellite. I mean, and it's all, these were all things one should have kind of seen going into it. Yeah. I think he did like try to start some feuds. I was privately suspicious. I know when there was the report of Coast to Coast blocking his guests. I mean, Martin and I had talked about that, you know, through some emails, and I was kind of like, I just think there's something there. I think maybe he wasn't as successful as he thought he was going to be initially, or it's harder than he remembered, or
something else going on. I think that's why he quit.
Yeah, I mean, that's me too.
Yeah.
So
here's a funny aside. I'm not a fan of George Nuri. And I've been listening to him lately. I'll pull up the his show on YouTube. And do you notice how much he's upped his game since Art Bell came back on? He's much more engaged, more personable, much more chatty than he used to be. And I enjoyed him better. And when then I heard that Art was going, I thought, well, then he'll go back to being awful again.
I think you might have offended Michael. That's Michael's hometown boy there.
Yeah. I know.
Well, actually, he's from Detroit. He's from Detroit. He's not from St. Louis. He was in St. Louis for a long time. No, I mean, I liked the show better with Art than I do with George. But I think George eats a lot of criticism from the way Art Bell did things because, you know, Art would do a five-hour show, but he'd have five guests, or he'd have three guests. You know, George a lot of times will have a single guest, and people tend to forget, particularly people who are more into the subject, that I think most people don't sit down and listen for four solid hours. Most people are in and out of their car, they're doing something, so you kind of have to repeat yourself a lot. I forgive him a lot of those things because I notice when I am doing things, and I am frequently doing things at 2 and 3 in the morning, that, you know, some of the weekend hosts, I can't follow the show if I, you know, run in and come out and doing errands or doing whatever. I can't follow the show. Whereas with George, you can. And if you sit down and listen for the four-hour block, that's probably really annoying. But if you are, you know, going about your business, which you have to figure, you know, it's 2-3 in the morning across the country, you are looking at people who are professional drivers. Everybody always says, oh, those are truckers. Obviously, they listen to four. But actually, a lot of the people who are driving around at night aren't necessarily truckers. They're policemen. They're delivery men. You know, a lot of serial killers work at night, but a lot work in the daytime, too.
I can't say I agree with you wholeheartedly because George, the thing, and I would listen to the whole programs. George would not follow up on really pertinent, interesting information that a guest had just departed. He would change the subject or break for a commercial and never pick it up again. It was mind-boggling. One time somebody was saying that they had been abducted, taken to a spaceship, and on the spaceship was a well-known astronaut who had also been abducted. George broke for, I don't know, probably started talking about his Navy days or something right in there. Never, ever asked her who the astronaut was.
Wow. Yeah.
I just about lost my mind.
Yeah. The only, you know, I like George. The only, you know, negative thing I say kind of is along the same lines, where I don't think when someone says something way out of whack, he doesn't try it. He never seems to try them on that in any type of way. He just kind of sort of almost sounds like he buys into it and moves along. But other than that, I think he's very talented. Of course, he wouldn't be there if he wasn't.
I give him an out. He does this every night, night after night after night. It's got to get old for him after a while.
So the other thing, I mean, he's always said he believes his forum is to allow the people who come on to say their piece. So he doesn't tend to challenge people. And that is the one thing I really wish he would change. I think every now and then you have to just be like, hey, you are obviously
an
idiot. You did not, I don't know, get transported as a child to Mars with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
I mean, you just got to put that there.
Yes.
All right.
Barry.
Yeah.
He was known as Barry in those days. Okay.
Well, I want to just add one little story here to the last part of our show. Outgoing DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano warns the new incoming secretary of serious cyber attack and unprecedented natural disaster, the likes of which this nation has never seen, is likely on its way. That didn't even make the mainstream media. I mean, that's quite an announcement. And when someone says something's on its way, it sounds like it's moving, possibly through space. You know, I'm starting this little conspiracy here. But that's kind of disturbing. And what do you think about that?
I don't think it's a big deal at all, honestly. I mean, what are you going to say? We got everything covered, totally cut our budget. I mean, we've seen some natural disasters the last few years. Most will become larger as the population grows. That's just the way it is. You know, Superstorm Sandy, that's a perfect example. You know, that hit a very populated area. We have more very populated areas. Therefore, natural disasters have a better chance of affecting a greater amount of people. That's just common sense. Cyber attacks, yeah, no kidding. That's completely on the rise. And I think it was not really covered because it's kind of a non-issue. Sorry to squash your conspiracy.
Well, I disagree with you. I thought it was a big issue, and the way she announced it was not very fair to the public. I thought it was kind of frightening. You know, very nebulous. Well, what, you know, the likes we have never seen, please. That's big. I myself am going to go out and buy a month's supply of chocolate. I don't care what you say, Michael.
Chocolate. That's good. Hey, so, you know, we went a little long in the news today. I want to thank you both. And thanks, Peggy, for joining us.
You're welcome. It was fun. Nice to talk to you guys.
Yeah. And we have a little tune by Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse we're going to play right now. And after that, we have our interview with Mark D'Antonio. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Peggy.
Thank you, Martin.
It was good to talk to you both. Well, I'll talk to you next week, Martin.
So I'm with Mark at the New England UFO Conference. How are you doing, Mark?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Really enjoyed your talk. You just got off the stage a few minutes ago, and you ended with a toilet paper analogy. We'll have to talk about that later. Now, we like to talk a lot about the science side of things. And so can you quickly give your background and then touch on some of the subjects you were speaking of?
Sure. My degree is astronomy. I spent my college years in cold observatories, taking photos from midnight to dawn, then going to classes all day, taking cat naps in the back of the boring classes, and then going back into the observatory from midnight to dawn again, weekends included, to do studies of nearby stars.
Wow.
Okay, and so the astronomy background was something that I had been doing ever since I was a child. I mean, I had been looking at the sky ever since receiving a telescope as a gift as a 9-year-old. And when I when I looked at that first image through the telescope, I called my parents out and I said, look, it's a crater on the moon. And they looked in and they went, oh, that's wonderful, wonderful. And then years later, I reproduced that same scene and said, that's not what I saw as a kid. My parents were just being nice to me. It was a lens flare. I wasn't even on the moon. And they were just saying it was – so, you know, we learn as we move, right? So the astronomy background is from an early age, and we live and learn, live and learn. But then as I got older, I began to take an interest in unidentified flying objects only because I firmly believe that we're not alone. And mm-hmm. so that took me down the path toward the Mutual UFO Network and MUFON. I'm currently their chief photo and video analyst, so whenever there's something cool that comes along, I get to see it, and it's really neat. And then we analyze the video. I have someone that works with me that I have on my team for MUFON, and we actually have a little photo analysis unit that we've created that will allow us to pretty much decipher anything we get.
Do you ever have feedback or hear from Dr. Bruce Maccabee on – I know he does analysis too. Do you ever confer
sure.
with him?
Actually, Bruce and I have talked back and forth a few times. In fact, I've met him at conferences several times, and – you know, what he has said is, you know, he'll look at me. I remember him saying to me one time at a Denver conference, he said, you know, I've looked at film and photos. He says, but when it comes to the digital world, he goes, you know, I just send that stuff to you. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, he sort of said it the same way, not quite the same words because I don't remember the exact words. But, yeah.
Now, I'm going to be jumping around a little bit here, but I got to tell you the most impressive thing that I saw and I never knew existed in your speech was the actual picture of a solar system out there other than ours.
Yeah.
I didn't know that existed, and that is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I talked to the people that work on the Gemini telescope up at Mauna Kea in Hawaii, and one of the most interesting photos to come out of that research was that photo that I showed in the talk, which illustrates the first time we've ever seen a solar system as a whole, with multiple planets around the star. Now, the black center disk that you saw there was just something to block the glare of the star, as I said in the talk, because most of any other inner planets that might be in that solar system are long lost in that glare of the star. And we just can't see those yet. We can see what they do to the light of the star, mm-hmm. if they do anything, if there's any there, but we can't see them directly.
Now, in your whole study and the years of being involved in this, how excited are you about Kepler and the exoplanets that they're finding?
Well, I've said this before, and that is that I do believe that we will find extraterrestrial life, microbial or otherwise, via exoplanet research. I think that's the only way in which we're going to find life elsewhere. The reason I say that is because when we look at planets far away using exoplanet research capabilities and techniques, what we're looking for are signatures of life that we can see in spectral analysis of a star or of the in the star wobble. We see the movement to pinpoint, say, where a star is. We see the Doppler shift of the color of the star's spectrum, indicating it's being tugged by a planet forward and backward and forward and backward, which causes the light to go blue, then red, you know, as it goes farther away. So using scientific principles, we're going to find more planets than we already have. Currently, the estimate, and it is going up, is that there's probably about 17 billion habitable planets in our galaxy alone.
That's amazing.
It is, when you consider also that the Hubble Space Telescope pointed at a thumbnail, at arm's length, thumbnail-sized piece of space.
Mm. The deep space photo.
Yes, mm-hmm. and counted in that one photo 1 million galaxies. That says a lot, because how many more thumbnails of space do we have all around us? Thousands upon thousands. So the numbers are staggering, and part of the problem we have as human beings is our brains are not wired to handle large numbers. Mm-hmm. They're wired to handle up to about a thousand. You know, I was going to say a grand. 1,000, right? So when you get up to about 1,000, then beyond that, you know, we kind of go all rubbery and we go, well, and the rest of those guys out there, you know. But the truth is, when we look at numbers that are that big, staggeringly large numbers, we have to engage both sides of the brain. So we have to be able to, you know, have data that shows both the creative side and the analytical side a way that kind of seats in the people's mind, you know, yes, these planets are really, really far away. right? Mm. Here's an analogy to show how far away they are.
Yeah.
And that gives people the idea. The reason I'm saying that is because scientists like the numbers. You know, scientists love numbers. Numbers are fine. Numbers work because that's just what, you know, we like to calculate with, right? When we calculate distances to planets, we use numbers. We don't say, and here's a quarter, you know, 500 miles away. Okay, that's the same diameter. We don't play with analogies like that, right? If when I do it or when a scientist do it, I feel that if we take and we look at educating everybody, all right, we will reach a place where exoplanet research will become commonplace. It'll become every day, which is where it needs to go. It needs to be in common practice, and people on the street need to understand it because it's important, because that's how we're going to find the alien life. You know, and I can tell you that when you ask how we'll find alien life.
Yes, I will ask in a minute. I've said this before in some of the past podcasts that a lot of people live day to day. They're doing their job and their own little world, and they really have no care, really, unless it somehow affects them. Then there's people that really think about it, like myself. And I thought I had a UFO sighting, but long before that, I was looking up at the stars for many years and have a very strong interest. I wouldn't call myself an amateur astronomer, but I just call myself a person that has a fascination with astronomy.
Sure.
And an analogy I heard once was if the sun was the size of a grapefruit, the first star would be in California.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, that kind of has your right and left brain working together to figure it out.
It does. Like if you make the solar system the size of a coffee saucer, then the nearest star is in Washington, D.C., you know? So you see, you can do those other kinds of things. So we drop it even smaller, you know, because the sun there is really, really small.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and so – but that kind of visual help is very important, especially when you tell people that to get to the nearest star using conventional technology would take every bit of 19,000 years – at the fastest speed we can currently travel.
Right.
And people go, well, I don't know. Who's going to go? You know, who cares?
Yeah.
The reason we care is because physics horizons that we can see show us that we can actually get to Alpha Centauri perhaps in as little as 2 weeks. In Star Trek, when Gene Roddenberry came up with the concept of warp drive, I guess he could never have envisioned that the actual physical concept of warp drive might actually be postulated someday.
Like warp bubbles, as they say?
Correct. And mm-hmm. And when you talk about you know, warp bubbles, then we go to Miguel Alcubierre in 1994, who first postulated at the time what was nearly science fiction, that we could actually create, eventually, effectively a warp drive that would literally allow us to contract. This is how it would work. It contracts the distance between us and our target and lengthens the distance between us and our origin point. So we push away from the starting blocks and pull ourselves toward the target, in a sense. But we're contracting that distance. Now, with the right amount of energy, we can actually affect a change in the space-time continuum, which is a real thing. You know, people don't know, wow, it's really there? It's really something? It's not science fiction? No. The space-time continuum is the fabric of space. It's a mathematical construct that's proven right with analysis and observation. So as we contract that distance with the right amount of energy, and that's the key, energy, then we can actually shorten the effective distance that the ship has to travel. Now, if you're on Earth watching this ship go into, say, Alcubierre mode, and it's going to head off to Alpha Centauri, would you suddenly see the star Alpha Centauri zooming toward the Earth and looking like it's now right next door? No. See, now we have to talk about something called reference frames, and what things look like to you on the ground is not what things look like in the ship. You know, these reference frames, you know, when Einstein postulated with his special theory of relativity that someone in a ship traveling by at near the speed of light could just be working and carrying on doing their normal things, but anyone watching them from the Earth would look like they're frozen in time as they went by. From as far as they could see to as far as they could see, they would just look like they're frozen in time when they're near the speed of light. Yet on the ship, the guy's moving around. But with every movement you see, thousands of years could be passing on the Earth. Hmm. Now, that gives rise to all kinds of these paradoxes. One was the twin paradox. If you say this was Brother A, Brother B, Brother B takes off, goes to Alpha Centauri, say near, very, very close to the speed of light, comes back. Say he comes back in like 7 or 8 years, say 9 years. He gets home and he finds out that everybody he ever knew is dead for centuries. Or 100 years, and say, huh? How did that happen? well, it's called time dilation, and we have that to deal with too in the Einsteinian relativistic physics. But with the warp bubble, things are a little bit different. See, in the warp bubble, we're not actually doing a time dilation thing. We're actually altering space-time. We are taking the space-time continuum, and we're not violating the laws of physics, because effectively, to an observer watching this ship, it could look like it's zooming out of the solar system at way past light speed, if you could see it.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't, but that's a whole nother talk. But you would actually just see this ship literally above your head as it went into Al-Kabiri mode. You would actually see the ship just start to move, and then just be gone. It'd be gone, you know, because it would literally have moved out of the solar system and well into interstellar space.
Can I just interject something here? A lot of times when people say they see UFOs, they seem to, like, all of a sudden disappear.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a possibility? It's the same type of drive?
You're getting me started. And see, now what we see on our horizon, which just over our horizon is this Al-Kabiri drive potentially. Well, just beyond that are potential propulsion concepts that live within the realms of string theory and possibilities there. Now, there is a possibility that eventually we'd actually be able to leave our brain and not B-R-A-I-N, B-R-A-N-E, membrane, okay, in the string mm-hmm. theory world. We might be able to leave that membrane and sit in what's called the bulk, which you know about from Robert Schroeder's talk. That bulk sitting out here is a place where the same laws of physics that apply on the membrane don't apply. And there's no light speed barrier per se. Effectively, we could literally punch in anywhere else we want to in the universe. Now, I'm really abridging a whole lot here. But mm-hmm. we could effectively punch in anywhere in the universe in seconds. Now, that's distant future. But when I toilet papered the audience, which we still haven't talked about, we'll get to, I illustrated, for instance, how our history on the Earth is such a tiny little sliver of time overall, considering the vast history the Earth has been here, that a civilization that developed a few thousand years, a million years before us is certainly not at all out of the question. Those physics horizons that we currently see, they would have reached and passed. So it's possible that they found them. So mm-hmm. it's possible that they're applying the universe. It's possible they came here, dropped a probe, dropped their little biobots that look gray with almond-shaped black eyes, and they're just controlled creatures. They're just drones. They're probably biological robots, and moved on. It's possible that's what they did. Who knows? We don't know. So could we have been cataloged and visited? Absolutely. The history is replete with evidence that disparate cultures that have never talked had some kind of contact with something that made them all draw the same thing.
Mm.
I did a talk in Denver on petroglyphs and pictographs, and in that talk I showed something that I felt was worthy of mention, and that is that the halo that you see around deities in Renaissance paintings, that's not where you first see them. You see them in the Wangina paintings in the Northern Territory of Australia, in the Kimberley region. You see them in the cave paintings there. These halos, spheres around the heads of their deity creatures called the Wangina, said to live in the water, came from the sky. Now, those round halos on those creatures were drawn thousands of years ago in the caves by a culture that never had contact with anyone in Europe, anyone elsewhere. Yet here they are drawing halos. In Valcamonica, Italy, you have two warriors fighting with the helmets on, round halos around their heads. Okay, we have the halo. It's everywhere. In the same way in my talk, I talked about the building blocks of life we see almost everywhere we look. Well, in some of the cave paintings, you see halos everywhere. Why? Someone saw something that made them draw it. And so that's why I draw this connection. These cultures never talked. They've never had contact with each other. They came and went without knowing the rest of the world existed. And they still show the same things that you see in other cultures. I don't understand how that's possible unless someone came down that had some kind of device that was over the head like that. I don't even want to call it a space helmet. It could have been something different. It could have just been a light shield or a biological, filter, or something. It could have been something to protect them from the indigenous germs on our planet. It didn't have to be a space helmet per se like we see in 50s science fiction, the big round bubble helmet, To me, that seems too low tech for something that can go interstellar.
Right.
I could imagine a glowing force field of some kind, that was contained. We're actually getting close to that type of science. You know, there are delimited fields like that 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 are out there that people use. There's certain radars, in fact, that actually create a spherical halo around the emitter that is variable in size. It registers intrusions into sites. I'm familiar with those radars because we're going to use them on our UFO detection systems. But that said, so I see this stuff all over the place. That's where I was going with that.
Yeah. Getting back to travel, one of the things that pops in my mind is if you were going to go from point A to point B and you were going to go super, super fast like we're talking about, how would you avoid any space debris contact, or how would you land exactly where you want to land?
Well, with things like this Alcubierre driver I was talking about, we're warping space-time in that situation. So could we possibly collide with something? Yeah, maybe, but I'm not sure because we're not traveling in the same space.
It's kind of like folding over something?
You're traveling in folded space, and you're in a warp bubble. And that bubble is sort of a protected space, but I've got to be careful with the terms I use here because it's not really a protected space. Could you hit something? Yeah, you can, right? But the folding concept is something that, you know, I would have to say we probably have to flesh out more what that boundary looks like around the warp bubble before, you know, we can say for sure we're not going to hit anything, or, you know, we could get killed by a micrometeorite. Because we're talking about traveling at relatively ordinary speeds within the ship's time, you know, reference frame that I mentioned. But outside the ship, all right, you know, from the outside, Earth would get a report in 3 days, 4 hours, 22 minutes, say, okay, we're at Alpha Centauri, you know, we're going to just go get that pizza, we'll be home in a few days, or whatever, okay? So, but to the shipboard people, they're actually traveling a relatively manageable speed. They're not traveling at a speed that would destroy them, you know. They would be traveling at something probably far faster than what we do now, but it would be manageable such that they would not hit anything and would have notice because they've changed space-time. They're not racing at ungodly speeds.
Mm-hmm.
They've just changed space-time to make traveling at manageable speeds a much shorter distance.
What would be our chances of detecting life, and how would that be detected?
Well, you know, we know it's notoriously difficult even to see if there's life on Mars. You know, we know that, you know, maybe we saw methane, maybe we didn't. We're not sure. We think we did. Okay. And that's right in our solar system. So what business do we have trying to say there's life 77 light years from here around a tiny planet that's so small that it wouldn't even show up on the most powerful telescopes between now and 100 years from now, perhaps? Well, the reason we have a business saying that is because we can detect what the planet is doing to the star's light. And the way spectra works, spectrum is a rainbow of colors you see, and sometimes a CD, if you hold a CD up to the sun, you see a rainbow of colors on the face of that CD as you rotate it around in front of the sun in front of you. And so light is white that we see from the sun, and it breaks up into, well, Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Okay, and that color scheme in a star also is punctuated with dark bands. Dark vertical bands. Those vertical bands correspond to certain chemicals in the star's hot atmosphere that are absorbing some of the energy at that particular light wavelength. Those are called absorption lines. And we look for absorption lines in the star's atmosphere to help us actually classify what kind of star it is. And in the early days of spectral analysis, the stars were all classified that way. An A star, for instance, has nice, broad, fat hydrogen lines in a specific place and order in the star's spectrum, and that's called the Balmer series. And those lines are just – they stand out in an A star as bright as possible. Before that, they're not as bright in the different – you know, the stars that, you know, that come before an A star in the sequence of the types of stars. And after that, they get progressively weaker in the stars that come after that type of A star. So the A star is sort of like the little metric. You know, it's the guy at the head of the parade that tells us. It's not the brightest star, that's not the hottest stars, but it's the one with the brightest lines, say, in hydrogen gas. The reason I'm saying that is because when a planet is transiting in front of a star, we can see that star's spectrum. We know what it's made of. It'll have some hydrogen dark bands. We talked about those absorption lines. It'll have metal bands if it's like our sun. Metals, calcium and magnesium, okay? We'll actually see calcium lines in our sun spectrum, two of them side by side called the H and K lines. This is what they are. You know, this chemistry absorbs some of the energy from those wavelengths and kind of darkens the spectrum in a little tiny thin band. And now, if we see a planet come in front of an ordinary spectrum that we are now familiar with of a star, and we suddenly see a strange, what we'll call a contamination in the star's spectrum, that means something moved in front of the star that put those elements into the spectrum. Hmm. And what are we seeing? Well, wait a minute, that's water vapor, oxygen? Hydrogen, yes, maybe. I don't know. Methane? Look at that. We'll see molecular signatures. Those are called molecular bands. And those will indicate to us that we might have actually caught a little piece of this planet's atmosphere affecting the star spectrum.
Hmm.
You need tremendous resolution of telescopic equipment in order to see such tiny influences. And it's really hard. You know, but we're working toward it. The research teams actually are looking for that. They've already been able to detect methane, oxygen, water vapor in some planetary spectra already, as seen in the as they pass in front of the star. And that's only going to get better. There is a certain limit we can do, though, ground-based.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be out in space with much, much bigger systems, right, you know, to see that. And when people say we need, like, a permanent base on the moon, okay, well, no, we don't. Okay, why? Because we have our feet on the ground, so we think we need to have ground under us all the time? No, no, no. A big orbiting observatory would actually be easier to build. We might use material from the moon, okay, and use that material to make the metal we need to make the stuff out in orbit. And I know that sounds like distant science fiction, but it really isn't. You know, I mean, there's big companies on Earth now that plan on mining asteroids, and they're actually taking in lots and lots of money to do it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know who I'm talking about because you're about to say it. But, you know, that all said, just to stick on this for one second, to see those planets, we're going to need that kind of resolution of the spectra. And then think about this. When we find a planet that's in the zone that isn't too hot, isn't too cold around its star, nice, long, live, stable star like our sun, of which there's billions and trillions, not in our galaxy, but overall in the universe. When we see that planet, and then we catch oxygen. That says something specific to us. Oxygen, as I have said before, doesn't want to stay in a planetary atmosphere. Now, if it's a gas giant, that's a different story because, you know, it'll bond over time with whatever it can within the gas giant's atmosphere. But then whatever's left over will just stay there and get acted on by solar light. You know, ultraviolet light can do things and maybe create ozone or whatever from, you know, other materials, other molecular interactions. But one of the things that we want to look for is that diatomic oxygen molecule, O2. We're looking for that. Now, if, say we see it, we can say that if it's a terrestrial rocky planet, a planet like ours, in the habitable zone, what that says to us is that that planet is pumping oxygen into the atmosphere through some means.
Mm-hmm.
Because oxygen doesn't want to stay in an atmosphere, the planet will tend to put it in, try to put itself into equilibrium, okay? Not like a living being, but just because the chemistry operates this way. It'll try to put the oxygen into as many compounds as it can because oxygen loves to bond with everything, well, lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that said, you know, we know it oxidizes lots of things. It's an oxidizer. It's a, you know, it can be a tremendous problem, okay, for, you know, for people who work in the metallurgy field. But when you see oxygen in the planet's atmosphere, it indicates that something is replenishing it, and that something is going to very likely be life if that planet is in the habitable zone.
Yeah.
Because habitable zone means what? Liquid water.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found, if we're any example, that liquid water leads to life in a habitable zone planet. In natural processes, the building blocks are made.
Yep. One of the things I had mentioned a few weeks ago on the show was the 17 billion planets. I didn't know that was a statistic till I heard you talk today. But think of, there's also moons, and moons also have a possibility of having life on them as well.
That's true.
So that would add quite a bit to it. Before we talk about the toilet paper, because we're wrapping it up, how do you like that?
That was bad.
That was pretty bad, wasn't it? Yeah. Let's talk about SETI. I've had Seth Shostak on a couple of times, mm-hmm. and I thought you made some really good points about the limitations of SETI. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, SETI is it's a great program, don't get me wrong, but one of the things that I have a problem with is that SETI is listening for sounds that the universe itself makes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we're the universe radio spectrum that where SETI is listening, the universe has it's a noisemaker. I mean, it emits radiation in many different electromagnetic
pulsars and everything.
Exactly. We mm-hmm. hear, you know, coming from stars that have died and are spinning so fast that they can't even seem to hold together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we hear noise in the universe as it is. My problem is that if we're going to try and listen for a civilization or send signals like we did out to a civilization, by the time those signals are at 100 light years from their source or from us, they have degraded 10,000 times because their radiation frequency, well, the strength falls off by the square of the distance. So, you know, you should do the math, 100, you know, squared. So when you get signals that far out, you know, they begin to blend with the noise that stars make, the noise that the universe makes. So unless you're looking at a spot that's really quite particular where there's nothing else, mm-hmm. you know, you really don't have a lot of chance of detecting something above the din that the universe makes. My opinion.
Yep.
Seth Shostak might have a very different opinion. You know, obviously he does because he's fully invested in SETI and making it work. I'm all for it. I want to see SETI work. But I think that detecting oxygen in the atmosphere of an exoplanet is another way that actually gives us something that we can actually do with some relative certainty.
Okay. Now, as far as getting the left and the right brain, again, I want you to discuss your toilet paper theory and before you...
toilet paper and, theory, I like
yeah. And while you're at the end of that, I want to tell you quickly about I had a sort of a debate where I had a skeptic on that had brought up something that kind of fits with this, and that is the chances of life being here in such a small fragment of time and life being somewhere else on such a small fragment of time because everything becomes extinct usually, thinking the way we think on this planet and what's happened on this planet. His theory against life visiting us is how can those two meet at the same time, like that small fraction of time that they're there, the small fraction of time that we're here. So if you would run through what you showed in the toilet paper and then wrap it up with your thoughts on that.
Sure. The problem that we have as human beings is that you can be told numbers. The Earth is 4.6 billion years old. Wow. I have no clue what that means, right? No one does, typically. But you have to engage some type of analogy, some type of mental helper that will assist you in having some knowledge or some idea of what those numbers mean. So I use something that I've used for many years. It's a simple roll of toilet paper. And I have the distinction of being able to toilet paper my audience at the end of my talk. And I absolutely love it. I make no apologies for it. Part of the problem is that, you know, in order to show just how long we have been here as a human race versus how long the Earth has been here, just degrades to a discussion of large numbers, billions of years versus millions of years versus 30,000 years. That doesn't mean a whole lot, but when you see it visually, that means a lot, and it helps see the concept visually, which is where it all starts. So I have a roll of toilet paper, 350 sheets, 117 feet long. And these start off as you unroll the roll. And yes, I did draw on all the sheets of toilet paper. Before anyone says, that guy is a nut, I already know. Thank you.
And you taped it with tape.
And I taped a central thing called a pull member so that you don't have the problem of tearing it when you pull it off the reel and you have people helping you who don't know how hard to pull or whatever.
Yeah.
But I started on the very first sheet that's exposed, and I wrote 4.6 billion years. That's when the Earth was formed, and then we begin to unroll. And sooner or later, just a few sheets in, we see that the moon has formed. And as we continue to unroll, and continue to unroll and continue to unroll and continue. You get the picture.
About how many feet would you say?
It ends up being the total roll is 117 feet from where the Earth formed to where we are. And people are amazed to find out that dinosaurs are only approximately 3.5 feet away from us on the toilet paper roll. They think dinosaurs are way back at the beginning. It's not true at all. They're very recent development in the history of our planet. So now you take that and you bring it all the way to the last sheet, which, of course, is where we are. And you go all the way to the end of that last sheet. And we are 0.001 millimeter in width. Everything we've ever known, everything we've ever done, the entire influence of human history is in a space 0.001 millimeter.
Out of that 117 feet.
That's correct. And now, 100 feet versus millimeter. But, okay, we can translate that to, I did it in the book. I actually write, I do both metric and imperial, just so you can see. But anyway, as I did that, I came up with, this thing where at the end, about a half inch in from the end.
That's where we are.
That's Homo erectus.
Wow.
Yeah, that was 1.3 million years ago.
Isn't that so?
Okay, about a half inch. Not quite a half inch, actually, a little less. And then you get a little closer, okay, and, I didn't really want to draw the lines from Neanderthal and all that because that was right at the very end, which seems odd, out of 117 feet. Yeah, they're our freaking brothers, man. They're just right down the road, relatively speaking. But then again, we are that little tiny piece. Now, the point I was trying to make was that, say we just take that last sheet, tear it off the roll, and besides it making me mad because I've done all that work, if we had that little tiny 4-inch piece in our hands, okay, or so, and I take that and I go, what if a civilization developed 1.5 inches in? All right? How far back is that? Eek, that's going to be like 4.5 to 5 million years ago. Wow. Well, we see planets that have survived the death of their star already, and we see planets just now in formation. So that says to us that planets are forming and planets are dying in a sliding window through the whole time span of the universe. And that means that a civilization could have been born, lived, and died, and we'd never even know about it because the planet might have been swallowed by a nova or a supernova of their star or destroyed when it went to red giants, and bloated up. But on the other hand, there could be, because there are so many stars that are habitable, the statistics are on our side to indicate that there is a likely overlap of a tremendous amount of time. So it's actually kind of short-sighted to say that everything has to line up exactly to have one civilization see us at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't. Because we have 17 billion potential habitable planets just in our galaxy alone, and because just over our horizon in our tiny little sliver of existence, we already see propulsion travel to the stars that could take us there in very, very short times. And because that doesn't look like science fiction as much anymore to us, the fact is that there's probably a lot of civilizations out there all plying the stars in parallel. That's the problem. We keep thinking linearly.
Yeah.
And we have to realize that the universe is developing in parallel to us. There's all kinds of other development going on.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know whether there's fishes developing in Europa's oceans, but there might very well be. And if there are, they're developing in parallel with life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where they started versus when Neanderthal died. Dead end, the evolutionary dead end. We don't know. But we do know that that parallel development begets a tremendous amount of possibility for parallel exploration, overlapping exploration, overlapping discovery, mutual discovery. So I don't buy that, there has to be some type of special point in time that has to be met and that it's that way at all. Because to me, it's not just one point. It's thousands, millions of points all at the same time. And each civilization is moving at its own speed in various directions in the universe. The fact is there's probably a possibility that multiple types of civilizations have found this in the past.
Very possible. Do you think that time is the same everywhere?
Should I answer in Russian or Chinese?
Yes.
No, I don't know. time is the same everywhere. Well, time is dictated by convenience and by convention. We created time based on the passage of the moon. many moons ago. My mother's part Native American, so I grew up with the Passamaquoddy culture and kind of thing. Not in my house, but just in general in my head and throughout our, you know, our life. And so time is sort of relative. You know, what do we use to measure time? Well, we can use molecular vibrations that are common throughout the whole universe. And we can make that a gauge for time. And we do. That's why we have an atomic clock. Mm-hmm. Okay, the atomic clock is doing that. Well, guess what? An atomic clock here and an atomic clock elsewhere will be going at the same rate.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
If you thought.
Because time in it, at some level will be the same wherever we go. Now, again, we got to be careful how we say this. If we are observers of a fast-moving ship going by, time's going to be different. Even that atomic clock's going to look like it's moving differently. Now, that is because of the time dilation issues with special relativity. We won't even have to get into that. But let's just say if we could just look at a planet 500,000 light years away and this planet 42 light years away and then this one 1,000 here and 1,400 there, let's look at all their clocks now, the atomic clocks. Are they all the same? My answer is they probably are.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're atomic clocks. And atoms of hydrogen work the same way 500,000 light years away as they do right here on Earth, and you know, in space and in our sun. And you know, so they work the same way.
I would love to have you on the show again sometime if you're up for it.
Sure, but I've said everything I know. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I know you said that you can talk for at least a couple of hours on what we basically went over quickly. And I really, really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
and
a lot.
Maybe next time we can talk about photo and video analysis, which is what I do for MUFON. So.
Absolutely.
Great stuff. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our show. And please remember to check out our website, podcastufo.com, for the latest blogs and forums. We never like talking about money, but we rely on your support. On our sidebar, we have a subscription button where you can help us out for under the cost of a couple of cups of coffee a month. If you cannot help us out, we still appreciate every single listener. Thank you, and remember, keep your eyes to the sky.